Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and I'm just here on the introduction today as Joe will be taking the lead on this interview with Dr. David Button of the University of Birmingham, all about feeding ecology. First, just a quick update on our virtual Natural History Museum campaign. We really need your help on this, people. The campaign is going to go right down to the wire, and if we don't meet our target in 2 weeks' time, well, that's it. We just won't be able to launch the project. It's all in aid of a good cause. Earth science teachers have been crying out for help in accessing paleontological multimedia, and we're trying to develop a website that brings together digital resources from all over the web. It's for teachers, it's for students, for gamers, for you. If you're listening to this podcast, then hopefully you'll be able to understand how multimedia can be used to educate and to entertain no matter where you live or what time of the day it is. So, if you enjoy this episode or even learn anything from it, please consider donating to the project. Any amount is welcomed and it might make all the difference to paleontological education. As always, the supplementary material to this episode is available on our website, and if you could help give us a boost on social media, that'll always be appreciated. Anyway, sit back, relax, and enjoy this interview with the very entertaining Dr. David Button.
So today I'm joined by Dr. David Button.
Hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
Not so bad. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
So that's great. You're ready to deliver these people a fresh dollop of hot content this afternoon?
Of course.
Great stuff.
So me and David have known each other for a long while now, since 2007.
Yep.
We did our undergraduate degree together. And
seems like a lifetime ago, doesn't it?
We both did PhDs at the University of Bristol. And David, you are now at the University of Birmingham.
That is correct.
What are you doing there?
So currently I'm at the University of Birmingham working with the Butler Research Group there, looking at the using biogeographical analyses to look at the evolution of provinciality within Pangaea, sort of doing the Triassic, and the kind of impacts on animal distribution that the mass extinctions at the start and end of the Triassic had.
Amazing. Today we're going to talk mainly about your PhD work on biomechanics and paleoecology. But first, how did you get interested in paleontology?
That's a kind of difficult one to answer. I'm not entirely clear. I think I've always been into natural history and the natural world. And in particular, I was always quite interested in whole organism biology. And as a youngster, you know, you'd read all the natural history books and you'd watch all the TV shows and I'd get into it. I think quite a big part behind that was that I'd exploit library chauvinism to be able to get out adult level dinosaur texts from the children's section of the library whenever mum would take us there every week, which is doing our shopping, which is also a good advert there for the importance of public libraries. But so I got interested obviously in dinosaurs this way, as part of like the broader system of natural history. And as I got older, I suppose, and more modern biology seemed to be more and more molecular focused, I then sort of got more interested in paleontology then because of the dedication still to whole organismal biology. And then, so then I decided to do it for university and just sort of went forward from there.
We're going to be talking about paleoecology today, but could you tell us what exactly paleoecology means?
So much in the same way that ecology is essentially the lifestyles of modern animals and how they interact with the environment, the ecosystem which they're in, paleoecology is unraveling this for extinct taxa based upon fossil remains. And this is something which might seem very, very difficult to get at because obviously for modern animals, quite a lot of observational data is used to establish their ecology. But there are different signatures left in the fossil record that we can still use to address this issue in extinct animals.
And one of the key aspects of ecology is diet, obviously. So what things are eating. Is this easy to infer from fossil evidence?
So feeding previously been my research focus, as all those who've met me full well know. It's one of my primary interests. But as you say, it's a very interesting part because feeding really dominates much of what an animal does in its environment. And evidence of this can be left in the fossil record. So a big thing which people have always used to establish what things ate is through comparison of the morphology of the teeth, and that in general, modern animals, you can see that carnivores tend to have sharp teeth suitable for dispatching prey and shearing meat, whereas, you know, herbivores will have flatter teeth for grinding, or denticulate teeth for shredding plant matter, and then piscivores will have sharp spikes for slippery fish and that sort of thing. So this is often used broadly to establish diet. But there are problems with this generally in that morphology, so that is the shape of the teeth and form of the skull or appendages, doesn't always map very closely with feeding behavior. A good example of this is the skull of a panda or a fruit bat. Either of these, if you took them in isolation, they'd look like they'd have carnivorous teeth. So we have to use for other pieces of evidence as well. Similar to the comparison of the teeth, we can look at the whole body. We can see if it has like claws potentially for capturing prey, or if it has legs developed either for speed or sort of for jumping on things as part of an ambush. And then there are other indirect lines of evidence as well. We can look, for example, at isotopic signatures, so chemical signatures, which vary with diet, as you might get onto, as well as then more sort of, as I've done in the past, more sort of numerical functional analyses of aspects of an animal skeleton. And then on top of that, wear patterns, so both macro and micro wear, so big scale versus tiny scale features left on the teeth by food that's been ingested. And these also give a signature of diet. Oh yeah, I guess I should have talked about the most direct evidence of all, which is fossilized, so coprolites, as I guess is aware, being fossilized dung, and coelites as like traces from gut contents, as well as certain animals, was also like at least purported fossilized sick and that sort of thing. And in each of these cases, these provide an excellent source of data on what something was eating, because obviously it's direct evidence. The trouble is the whodunit then of what the what the spool belonged to, as it were. So there's some quite fun little cases like that. So like it can be quite easy to identify shark coprolites because they're corkscrewed due to the shape of the shark's gut. But in other cases, for example, there's been like big coprolites full of like mashed up dinosaur bone from late Cretaceous are generally thought to be those of tyrannosaurs because, you know, these are thought to be able to like mash up bone, which is fine, but it's also a bit circular. So they provide direct evidence, so it'd be hard to get down exactly which animal produced them. I guess what's really going to talk about this is ones we've got them with gut contents itself. If you've got like an animal with contents within its body cavity, that can be a really good indicator of what it's been eating.
And are there many fossils with gut contents?
There are quite a few. So the best known things, at least to me, with fossilized gut contents are the big late Cretaceous teleost fish, Xiphactinus, where loads of them have other fish preserved within their stomach cavity, which they sort of ate before they died. And in terrestrial ecosystems, you sometimes get, for example, there's some dinosaurs with preserved plant material in their guts, as well as some earlier reptiles as well. But this can be a bit problematic sometimes because it can be difficult to distinguish plant material that was originally in the stomach versus that has been washed in after death. The other problem with gut contents is it can be difficult to distinguish if that's what an animal habitually ate. And the Xiphactinus, the big fish, are a good example of that, because in many cases, these seem to have died choking on a big fish that they often as not another Xiphactinus that they were trying to eat. And so this is why as well you have to be very cautious that you're not seeing something which the animal ate unusually and that's what actually led to its death, or just like an unusual occurrence. So you have, so like of all lines of evidence, really, you have to be careful with it.
There's another example of that, a pterosaur one, I think you told me about as well.
Oh, yeah, there's a pterosaur one. It's where it's got a leaf which is perforated through its through the bottom of its mouth and got stuck in its beak. So it seems that the pterosaur was probably dip fishing or something and accidentally seized like a sharp palm frond rather than a fish or something like that and got it stuck through its mouth. And it appears that it was stuck in its mouth and it couldn't feed and so it starved to death. Which is, I guess is kind of sad, but then I suppose when we had the bones, we knew it was dead anyway, so it's not really that much difference to it. But just kind of a shame, because I thought they were the Earth's most well-adapted creatures.
Don't start me. So, yeah, it's just another case where you have to be careful interpreting these fossils. Obviously, the fact that this pterosaur presumably died eating this food means that it probably didn't eat that very often.
Yeah. Or at least it normally did with more skill and finesse.
So what kind of evidence can we get for predation in the fossil record?
with predation, we can sometimes be lucky enough to get bite or claw marks in fossil bones. So again, you have to be careful because it can be difficult to distinguish marks left by predation versus marks left by scavenging. So a lot of the time you might get tooth marks in bones, but these could easily just be left by something scavenging on the carcass. The best instances of these is where we've had regrowth afterwards. So I believe there are some trilobites with spines and things bitten off, which show evidence of growth back afterwards. And also the tail of the duck-billed dinosaur Edmontosaurus is one known with a bite mark in it, which matches the mouth of a tyrannosaur, but shows signs of healing afterwards, indicating that the animal survived the attack, then in turn proving that the predator was attacking live prey. So we can get this sort of evidence for predation. Again, it can sometimes be a bit of detective work to establish who left these marks, but by comparing those left with the teeth, claws, or other hunting appendages of animals known from the same environment, you can normally get a decent idea about who was preying on who.
So is it a case that you have to fit the tooth to the tooth mark sometimes?
Yeah, so it's a case of like seeing which the tooth marks, and also as well seeing which like jaws or claws would fit the sort of spur of teeth marks that you see.
So you mentioned that the actual shape of the tooth can sometimes be an indicator of what the animal was eating and if it was a predator or not. But how accurate is this? You mentioned the case of the panda and the fruit bat. Their teeth are obviously not that good an indicator of what the animal was eating.
Well, at least in broad scale anyway, if you compare in more detail, and especially if you compare them to their relatives of other diet, they'd show more signals then of being specialised towards the diets they have. But taken in isolation, those teeth could be quite misleading. So in general, teeth are quite good indication, but we have to be cautious for a couple of reasons. One is that shape does not always follow diet, like the panda and the fruit bat. And the other thing is, it's something called Liam's paradox, which is where animals which appear to be specialised for a certain food. So a good example of that is some fish with sort of very well developed jaws and big flat button-like teeth, which are good for shell cracking. You'd think from their morphology that they'd be specialised shell crackers, but it turns out that actually they usually have a very sort of generalised diet, and only will resort to shell cracking during times of stress. And so it's often an important thing to remember here in that animals will generally eat what they can, and they might only eat the things they're apparently specialised to do comparatively rarely. So this is another thing we have to bear in mind when you're looking at teeth, that you might be getting an overly specialised signal. Another problem as well is how good an analogue your modern animals are that you're using. So for example, many prehistoric reptiles are thought to be herbivorous because their teeth are similar to those of living iguana, a herbivorous lizard. But many of these reptiles, like early dinosaurs, for example, are not really closely related to lizards at all. And it's also worth bearing in mind that although iguanas mostly eat plants, they're actually omnivorous. They will eat some insect and animal matter as well. So we have to be cautious of the kinds of analogues that we use as well when using teeth as an indicator of diet.
It seems that teeth are a bit of a minefield when it comes to interpreting the diet of an animal. Is there any other ways that we can get at the diet of prehistoric animals?
So teeth themselves might be a minefield, but they're also a gold mine of information, in that we can also get wear patterns from them. And large-scale wear patterns, what's called like even macro or meso wear, have been very useful for some time, and that they show the ways in which the teeth occlude or do not occlude against each other. And using this, we can see the ways in which the jaws moved and how the teeth were then used, which could be useful for different things, whether they had a bite suitable for shearing through meat or shearing through plants, etc. And in particular, microwear is a technique which has been used a lot more recently by various workers in the US and University of Leicester in the UK as well. Where minute scratches and pits left on the teeth by the food eaten or by grit or other things eaten along with the food will leave a signature which can then be compared with patterns from living animals to try and then get an indication of diet. So though teeth have their problems, they shouldn't really be written off because there are various things you can get into diet very, very well. In particular, microwear is a nice line of evidence because it doesn't rely, unlike all the other methods we're talking about, upon designations of morphology. So it provides a nice sort of independent line of evidence which you can then use to test against or combine with data from other methods on diet.
For For your PhD, though, you didn't work on Riker wear or tooth morphology, but rather biomechanics. So can you explain what biomechanics actually means?
So biomechanics is a very broad area of research in biology in general, because in both paleontology and with living animals, it essentially refers to any study looking at how they work physically. So this includes in modern animals, studies looking at how things move and using a variety of sophisticated techniques to image bones as they move and to look at firing patterns of muscles. So that way you can see when certain muscles contract and when they extend, and so the way in which animals achieve the movements in which they have. And this big body of work on living animals provides great comparative data, which you can then use for our fossil biomechanics work. And work in fossil taxa can go from the quite simple, so it can be just from measuring aspects of an animal's skeleton, such as the area of attachment of muscles, or the lever arms of muscles around pivots in the skeleton, like the jaw joint or limb joints, which can give us an idea of how they operate and the forces that would have occurred around these joints, right through to, through into looking at wear patterns of the teeth and using these to reconstruct jaw motions, which has been done using both mesawear and microwear techniques, which is quite interesting, because in this case, mesawear, so it's like relatively large-scale wear features on the teeth, they'll be left from the teeth acting against one another. So by looking at the orientation of these, we can see how the tooth rows would have worked against each other. And with microwear, scratches will be left by grit trapped between the teeth during feeding. So looking at the directions of these, we can see then the way in which the teeth would have operated against each other. And as well, ultimately, like the more time-expensive end of this, also detailed computer models of vertebrate systems like the skull and the jaw or limbs, which can be used to reconstruct stress or strain or forces or other things acting upon animal structures in if we attempt to replicate how they would have behaved. So it's a very broader way of approaches because it's a numerical way of looking at how animals lived. But that means, you know, there's lots of different results, and often in particular, which I think is very useful to do, is to use multiple different approaches and combine results between them to get an emergent picture of how an animal would have lived.
Okay. And so you were just saying that you can use the scratches on teeth to work out the motion of the skull. I never realised that.
So the study done, a study I quite liked on that was done by, Vince Williams and Mark Pennell at the University of Leicester and with Paul Barrett at the Natural History Museum in London, where they looked at microwear scratches on the teeth of Edmontosaurus, this duck-billed hadrosaur. Now, the hadrosaurs are a very interesting group of dinosaurs. Contrary to the fact that many listeners are probably most familiar with them in paleo art, where they're just tyrannosaur chow half the time, which is rubbish, because hadrosaurs are far more interesting than tyrannosaurs. Tyrannosaurs just going around biting everything, but to overcompensating how boring they were. Hadrosaurs have lots of interesting morphological features. And one is they've got these massive batteries of teeth. And if we look at the orientation of microwear scratches on these, well, as people have looked at microwear scratches upon these demonstrate the way in which the tooth rows have moved relative to each other. In particular, this showed something which had previously been hypothesized from mesawear features on the teeth, that the teeth of hadrosaurs moved side to side relative to each other. And this is interesting because although, you know, we're very used to eating by moving the jaw from side to side, and particularly like how we chew and how like cows very obviously chew, it's very rare in other groups of animals because mammals have a very specialized jaw joint and jaw musculature which allows them to do it. So providing more evidence that this was definitely the case in this duck-billed dinosaur is interesting. But however, although it shows us how the teeth moved relative to each other, so it shows us that the motions like this were occurring, it doesn't show us how they're performed, and in particular how hadrosaurs actually did this, whether it was due to slight movements between the skull bones or to wishboning of the jaw, still remains unsolved. And so other biomechanical techniques have been used to look at this a bit. And so again, it's how you need different lines of evidence which can fill in different pieces of data to acquire your whole.
So for your PhD, you looked at sauropod biomechanics, so the largest dinosaurs. Can you tell us a little bit about this work?
Yeah, sure thing. So this is what I did for my PhD at the University of Bristol in the Natural History Museum in London. And so the Sauropodomorpha were an aberrant group of stem birds, which, as you mentioned, were notable, and they produced the largest land animals that ever lived. Giant things like Argentinosaurus and Paralatitan and Alamosaurus.
Paralatitan?
Yeah, and
not heard of that one.
And Puertosaurus, which I quite like because that one's really wide, and obviously, you know, I quite like the really wide sauropods. They're quite funny. Especially, there's a sauropod I urge you all to look up, a Titanosaur, Opisthocoelacordia, just because, just the pictures of it are just funny. It's got really wide hips, and the femurs splay out as well. It just looks really funny. But these include like some of the biggest the biggest land living animals that ever lived. And this makes them of great interest because getting big is quite hard, but there's also lots of advantages to being big. You're more resistant to fasting and drought. You can cover larger distances. You have a broader feeding envelope. You're safer from attack from predators. Potentially a link, although it seems quite spurious, between it and digestive efficiency. But certainly for a herbivore, it means you've got bigger rooms for big guts for processing plant material. And also you can just eat a big amount of material in the first place. So there's good reasons for things to get big, but other land animals don't get as big as sauropods. So what's interesting to do is to try to disentangle the mechanisms just sauropods had, which allowed them to then break the limits which are present on all other land living animals. And there's been a lot of work looking at the various aspects of the sauropod body, like the neck and the main body cavity, and aspects about the breathing, which we can get at due to marks on the bones, fortunately. But what we focused upon was the head, because sauropod heads, you know, they're really small, look kind of silly on the end of this really long sort of neck. And so it was for a long time, back in the bad old days of paleontology, so like 100 years ago to about 50 years ago, well, 50 is a bit strong, about 100 to about 70 years ago, whatever. Sometimes the heads were seen as like, made them seem a bit like catastrophic failures that spent all their time slurping up algae in swamps. But it's become increasingly clear that the skull was only superficially simple, really. It actually represents a very specialized cropping tool, because if you think about like comparing to mammal herbivores, so these big batteries of teeth where they chew, sauropods didn't chew, they used the tooth entirely for cropping off plant material. And if you look at the head, there's actually a great variety of shapes and sizes and morphology in the head, which presumably would relate into differences in how they would have fed. However, as we sort of got at earlier, the morphology, so the form of something, an animal, doesn't necessarily follow how it functions. Animal body parts like skulls are very complex entities, and so small changes in morphology can result in very different changes in how they actually worked. So we wanted to get at this and also to put numbers on it by reconstructing the way in which the skulls and teeth of different sauropods would have worked and get an idea about how they would have fed. So this involved taking CT scans, which for our project were nicely provided to us by Larry Whitmer and his colleagues in Ohio, and also from the Museum von Attica in Berlin. But taking CT scans of the skulls was then very useful, because it allows us to apply various techniques which have become part of like the virtual paleo evolution, as it were, as some people have called it, where we can use this to then virtually reconstruct the specimen. And then particularly what we can do is we can then do what we say is retro-deform it. So when a fossil skull have been preserved, it will have had like holes and cracks develop in it, and we can correct for these to get rid of them. And in particular, it varies the specimen. So some of mine were fine. They were like pretty much as they would have been in life. But others, like the Plateosaurus skull I had, was much more squashed and sheared. But we could, through comparison with other specimens, we can undo all this to get like a model then of the skull as the animal would have been alive. As it would have been when the animal was alive, I should say. And then from this, we can use marks left on the bones to reconstruct the muscles of the jaw. So this is done through a technique which we call extant phylogenetic bracketing, which is quite a fancy term. But it essentially boils down to using the nearest living relatives of an animal to reconstruct tissues that which are not preserved, which are there. So in the case of these dinosaur skulls, we'd look at scars and other features left on the bones by the muscles of the jaw that we see in living birds and crocodiles, and use these together to reconstruct the muscles as they probably would have been present in a dinosaur skull. And this can at least allow us then to get a degree of confidence, or a confidence interval, on the muscle sizes and so muscle forces that have been in the dinosaur.
So you end up from taking your CT scans of like a squashed and cracked sauropod skull with a virtual model of a 3D skull as it would have looked like in life with the muscles attached to it.
Yeah, which is then good, because we've got the skeleton in life and then we also have muscles, we get an idea of the forces and then also the directions in which they'd have been acting upon the skull.
Okay, so what do you do next?
So my next step after this was to apply finite element modelling. With finite element analysis is a technique that was originally used in engineering but is now used quite widely in both biology and paleontology. And finite element analysis is a method where you produce a computer model which can reconstruct stress and strain patterns in a complex shape when it's being loaded by forces by breaking the complex shape down to a large number of simple elements with which the functionally resulting stress and strain can be easily solved and using these to produce patterns from across the whole structure. So in this case, what I did was I produced finite element models of the skulls and jaws of my sauropodomorph taxa, and then loaded these with the calculated muscle forces, and this then gave us resulting stress and strain patterns in these structures. And these can be used then to compare the way in which different structures acted under loading by the muscles, which can give us an idea of the relative properties into like bite force and also how well adapted different structures might be for different behaviours.
So, for example, if you wanted to test how these different skulls dealt with biting on a leaf, say, you could compare all these skulls in the virtually.
Yeah. And the important thing here is the comparative aspect. Because the thing we always have to be cautious about in this thing is that we don't have the actual values of material properties of dinosaur bone, and we don't have the actual, we don't have the precise values of the physiological attributes of dinosaur muscle, like the specific tension. So though we can put a range of best estimate values on the sort of essentially the toughness of dinosaur bone and the strength of dinosaur muscles, we don't know the precise values themselves. However, in a comparative framework, this is less of a problem because we can use the same assumptions for all of our different dinosaur models, and so we can correct for this difference between them. So that's why finite element analysis and bite muscle reconstruction is more useful when you're comparing between different dinosaurs to see the level in which different animals to see the level to which different ones are adapted performing different behaviors rather than just doing it on single taxa or in isolation. But again, as I got to before, it's a case of using different lines of evidence to address slightly different questions to get a bigger idea of the whole.
So you worked on some of the sauropods from the Morrison Formation, which is this most famous deposit in North America of Jurassic dinosaurs, including Stegosaurus and Diplodocus. So, which of the sauropods did you work on?
Yeah, so the Morrison's an interesting place, and so from there we looked at two in particular, which were Diplodocus, which I guess everyone's probably familiar with, and also Camarasaurus, which was another sauropod. And these two are quite interesting because they're both very abundant, and that Camarasaurus is the most abundant large animal in the Morrison Formation by some margin. And Diplodocus and the very similar Apatosaurus between them are also extremely abundant. And what's also interesting is that the Camarasaurus and Diplodocus are often found from the same quarry. So not only were they both quite abundant, but they also lived in the same time and place. And this is immediately kind of interesting because you've got these two animals which weighed between sort of 10 to 40 tons, depending exactly on the individual and the species, which were both living in this one environment, which wasn't like a lush forest or anything. The Morrison Formation was seasonally quite arid and seems to have been mostly made up of quite sort of dry, tough fern prairies with scattered trees. So the Morrison Formation story, how quite we could get this, like it was really, really rich dinosaur unit preserving the remains of loads of big dinosaurs. So as well as Diplodocus and Camarasaurus, with loads more sauropods like Apatosaurus and Zuvasia and Brachiosaurus and Supersaurus and all sorts, was something which we wanted to get at. And also Diplodocus and Camarasaurus are interesting because they lived alongside each other, but they were also very different. And particular in skull morphology, they occupy two like N members of the morphology we see in sauropod skulls. Diplodocus has this very elongate snout with the teeth restricted right to the end of the jaw, and with thinner, more delicate bones, whereas Camarasaurus has this big boxy skull with big sort of crunching teeth. And so a lot of work we've done previously suggesting that these very different forms of the skull and the jaws might then have resulted in differences to what these things would have eaten. So we wanted to address this using sort of rigorous modelling techniques, principally finite element analysis, to then get at differences in how these things would have fed. So this went for the methodology that before, I obtained CT scans of the skulls of each of these animals, reconstructed jaw muscles, and found that, as was expected really, the bite forces, which can be shot, these of Camarasaurus, are far more powerful. So whereas Diplodocus, sort of bite forces in the skull were sort of like 100, around a similar sort of range, what you might see in horses or cattle, those of Camarasaurus are sort of powerful, like a gorilla, sort of much greater bite forces, perhaps more suitable for cropping through woodier material. And then we performed finite element analysis on these things. Quite interestingly, when we modelled essentially both of them biting as they would in fed in life, resulting stresses and strains between the skulls were quite similar. And this is kind of what you'd expect, because modern animals tend to work to similar what's called safety factors. So essentially that in across modern animals, generally the highest stresses and strains that occur within the bone are similar between different animals and well below the absolute limits of bone strength, which makes sense because animals won't want to be routinely put themselves at risk of breaking their face or other parts of their body. However, when we accounted for the differences in size and muscle force acting upon these different skulls, so that is, we're just comparing how these skulls deal with imposed forces purely in the context of their different shape. We saw that stresses in the skull of Diplodocus were much, much higher than those of Camarasaurus. And this suggests that the sort of bigger, boxier skull of Camarasaurus is capable of accommodating and distributing much higher forces resulting from feeding that of Diplodocus. So if Diplodocus with a lower bite force and this sort of more delicate skull versus Camarasaurus, so these much higher bite forces and a skull which is then well adapted towards resisting these high forces and accommodating them within the skull. So this suggests then that Diplodocus would have been feeding upon finer, softer foods, whereas Camarasaurus instead would have been capable of crunching through like branches and coarser plants. And if we look at the rest, if we look at other lines of evidence, this makes sense of those. Tooth microanalysis performed by John Whitlock, for example, shows signals on the teeth of Diplodocus, suggested they ate ate finer foods as Camarasaurus, shows like pits and things more suggestive of feeding upon coarse woody matter. And this also makes sense of the rest of the body as well, in that Camarasaurus has quite high shoulders and seems like would have been browsing woody plant material from medium or high heights, whereas Diplodocus is often thought to have fed upon lower levels, at least most of the time. Another thing we also compared, though, as well as like biting, we could look at some other feeding behaviours that have been attributed to these animals. So in particular, Diplodocus had been suggested in previous works by people like Paul Barrett and Mark Young as well, to have stripped to have eaten in a what's called a branch stripping manner. So in Diplodocus, the teeth are restricted right to the front of the mouth, and they stick out at an angle of like approaching 45 degrees in front of the mouth, which is quite unusual. So suggested that they might have been used to clamp its mouth around plant material and then pulled backwards or downwards with movements of the head to strip off plant material, something which has been called branch stripping. And so we thought we could look at this or similar actions and use finite element analysis to model them. So what we did instead was I produced models where reconstruct not just the jaw muscles closing, but also we could map out the muscles on the, where they're attached to the back of the head, and use these then to, in our virtual environment, reproduce a model where we have the skull being pulled to rotate downwards by the muscles on the back of the neck in order to strip the teeth through plant material. And we find that in Diplodocus, this results in very low stresses because the slender teeth at an angle would result in low forces acting upon those as the head is pulled backwards along a branch. Whereas like in other sauropods, like Camarasaurus, if we try this, instead you get very, very high stresses building up in the teeth in the front of the snout because they've got very broad teeth. So if you have this sort of stripping along a branch, these are kind of almost leveraged out of the face, which results in some very high stresses. And so it seems that Diplodocus, whereas Camarasaurus was better adapted towards using large bite forces to crop through big branches, Diplodocus was seems to be more specialised towards using motions of the head to pull off or strip off plant material instead. So as well as us being able to get at differences, say, in bite force, which could have separated what they can eat, we can also get a degree of the differences in feeding behaviour, which they would have used in order to exploit different plants within the same environment. So together we get this idea of these two very different, these animals, although being quite similar in overall body form, actually being very different in ecology, and that's how they're able to both live in the same time and place by feeding upon slightly different plant resources. And this is a phenomenon we see a lot in nature called niche partitioning. So it was nice then to be able to demonstrate its presence in these prehistoric dinosaurs, showing that similar mechanisms would govern dinosaur paleoecology as governs the ecology of modern animals like antelope.
So what about the other dinosaurs of the Morrison, in particular Brachiosaurus?
Yeah, so Brachiosaurus is one of my favourite cases here to bring up something about dinosaur paleobiology and feeding in general. Because as I'm sure many people are often, you know, everyone's familiar with Brachiosaurus from Jurassic Park. And a bit which always really annoys me in Jurassic Park, my least favorite bit of the film, is when they're feeding the Brachiosaurus, the big cow, by giving it the plants to eat, if you watch, its mouth slides from side to side while it eats, like a cow, which sauropods couldn't do. Sauropod jaws worked in a simple up and down fashion, like those of most reptiles. This just really annoys me because it's like the assumption that, oh, all herbivores are cows, it's just a big cow, works just like a cow, didn't work like a cow.
That's the bit that makes you suspend your disbelief.
Yeah, it's just like, oh yeah, it's just a massive carnivore or theropod bias and everything. So, oh, I don't care, they're just cows, aren't they? No, they're not. Herbivores, you know, there's a wide array of morphologies which are and specialized feeding behaviors in herbivores, and generally I think they're much more interesting than carnivores, but other people don't, do they? Never mind. But anyway, so looking at other dinosaurs, we wanted to place the results that we had from Diplodocus and Camarasaurus in a broader context, look at other sauropods of the Morrison Formation as well. But producing these models is quite time intensive, and we don't have CT scans for all of the other specimens. So instead, I took measurements from the skulls and the jaws and the teeth, which reflect the way in which they would have worked. So this includes things like measuring the area of muscle attachment, again worked out from the scars I mentioned earlier, measuring the leverage of jaws around the pivot of the jaw joint, which would reflect how hard these things could have bitten. And then also looking at things like the style that the teeth occluded with each other, and things like the angle of the teeth and what they seemed to be adapted to do. And together, these data allowed us to compare how similar or different the sauropods were in the ways in which their jaws and teeth would have functioned. And we used this then, we could produce then a plot of how similar these things were, which you can call a function space. And we could use the results from our following element models of Camarasaurus and Diplodocus. We could use these to help guide our results here and have a look at how similar these other dinosaurs were and the way they would have worked to these other two. And what we sort of found here is you get a wide variety of different functional morphologies in sauropod dinosaurs of the Morrison. So Brachius, whereas like Diplodocus and other animals like Apatosaurus are quite similar to Diplodocus in that they would have had relatively low bite forces and seem to have been adapted to eating softer foods. Brachiosaurus is somewhat intermediate then between these diplodocids and Camarasaurus in that it has a stronger, more robust skull, a bit like that of Camarasaurus, but also the teeth meet in a more precise sort of nipping fashion. So perhaps we're going for like nipping through branches instead of more of the crunching bite of Camarasaurus. So in this way, it seems that as well as just Camarasaurus and Diplodocus, we could extend further and say that differences in the way in which these animals would have fed, underpinned by differences in skull morphology, as well as then differences in their neck and whole body morphology, would have allowed them to all coexist in the same place.
Well, David, it's been a pleasure to have you. Long overdue.
That kind of surprises me, really, to be honest. I guess what I mean is, that's very nice of you to say so. Many would not be so kind. If anyone enjoyed that out there, I'd be very happy for them to tell me. At the moment, I'm running on an absolute zero on the number of people who enjoy me using that statement, which I guess you mean would think I'd use it less often, but no, I use it quite a lot. You know, it's useful stuff.
I can attest to that. Anyway, thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.